Hi, I'm Nima.
Hi, I'm Berhan, and this is Terms and Conditions. So Nima, guess what happened here?
What?
The first COVID patient, when her name became public, somebody leaked her nude pictures. What the actual fuck?
But why? Why? What is the rationale? Why?
No, there's no, like, it's just, we just need to tell Kenya, gather yourself, please. Gather yourselves, your lives, your craziness. This is just unacceptable. Like, what's the rationale behind leaking somebody's nude pictures when they're actually recovering from a really terrible disease?
I can't really wrap my mind around it.
Yep.
Why was her name even pub? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get on with the episode.
Uh-huh.
This is a good segue because this is what we're talking about today. So this episode is about online gender-based violence, also known as technology-facilitated violence against women, also known as cyberbullying, also. As you can see, we don't even have an agreed-upon term to discuss this issue, which also makes things more complicated. But if we refer back to season one, which was pretty great, guys, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, our website. Check us out. We spoke with Sandra Quikiriza and Kulibe Majama about smashing the patriarchy and their digital security work with sex workers and women. And thinking back to it, one of the things that stood out for me from this conversation was how, for instance, teaching sex workers about simple WhatsApp privacy settings can lessen the abuse they might face from their clients. Even just disabling read settings can go a surprisingly long way.
Yeah, and you know, that episode was really good. One thing that I really took away from that conversation is that when we talk about, you know, the digital divide, when we were talking about connecting women, we should, you know, that conversation should be coupled with privacy and security, you know, asking the question of what kind of internet are we connecting women to? Is it safer? What digital literacy and digital security skills can be coupled with connecting women? Because nobody wants to be connected to this crazy internet now that is leaking patients' nudes.
Yeah, toxic internet, toxic people. Mm-hmm. Thinking about recently in Uganda, a prominent academic, Stella Nyanzi, she was sentenced to 18 months in prison on these controversial charges of harassing the president at the time through a poem on Facebook. And she was recently released earlier this year, so small wins. But she was arrested under an act called the Computer Misuse Act. And this act, especially in her case, is being used to harass, intimidate, stifle, repress, oppress critics of the government, and not particularly to protect women, which is what we're seeing across a lot of laws across Africa, in that they have a lot of vague wording, or that they were created not with safety in mind, but more with stifling government critics. And if we look at the case of Uganda again, because that's where we're based, the demographic and health survey revealed that up to 1 in 4 women aged 15 to 49 in the country had experienced some sort of sexual violence. And here we're talking about offline, because we don't actually even have the data yet for online. And we know that there's, of course, this offline-online continuum of violence. But sticking back to the case of, you know, non-consensual sharing of information, the first prominent case was in 2014 when Desire Luzinda, a celebrated Ugandan musician, she actually made a public apology after her ex-boyfriend leaked her nude images on social media. And after this incident, there have been tons of cases, as, you know, the most recent case that you mentioned, Berhan, by these jilted lovers, ex-boyfriends, scammers. And these women often face public shaming, ridicule, and basically delete their online selves. And what's even crazier is that in 2014, that same year, Uganda passed the Anti-Pornography Act. And a couple of years later, a pornography committee, was put in place. I mean, even saying that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
A porn committee. I am of the porn committee.
I represent the porn community.
I am the chairman of the porn committee. Anyways, was put in place to enforce the act. And this committee hounds and hunts these women whose private information has been leaked. And they investigate the women and question them morality while in oftentimes the perpetrators get away scot-free.
Why not target the men that leak those things?
Yeah, well, we have had a small win. This past year, in 2019, Martha Kay, who is a socialite, her images were leaked. They were all over social media. It was like the secondary perpetrators of this violence. How do you even begin to track them? But in a small win, two men who had stolen her phones were charged with aggravated robbery and also with cyber-stalking because they used her images and continued to harass her. So small wins, but on the other side, things are getting much worse. Have you heard about Deep Nude?
Okay, I'm scared now. What the fuck is that?
Well, I'm going to quote this from Vice. So they say that Deep Nude is an application created by a programmer and it uses neural networks to remove clothing from the images of women, making them look realistically nude. So it takes away your clothes and puts in naked breasts and vulva, but only on the images of women. So when Motherboard, another media agency, tried using an image of a man, it replaced his pants with a vulva.
Oh, God. Okay.
And this brings us to the point that oftentimes that these devastating negative uses of deep fakes have been used against women. You know, whether it's to experiment with the technology by using women's images without their consent or maliciously spreading non-consensual porn on the internet. Deep Nude is an evolution of that technology in that it's so much faster to use and create, and anyone with no knowledge of neural networks can simply declothe any woman out there and do God knows what with it. And it makes you feel that technology can claim ownership of women's bodies, which of course, as we know, the patriarchy has always had this idea, but technology now amplifies and puts it into and makes it easier to propagate and makes sure that these images live on forever on the internet.
Oh, that's really insane. This reminds me of a story that came out a few months ago about this new search engine technology that matches porn stars' face with their actual Facebook profile. So basically, somebody developed So somebody had this, for a lack of a better word, terrific ideas and terrifying idea at the same time.
Is this what we call innovation?
Yes, you know, startups, you know. So basically this individual developed an algorithm that crawled all the websites, all the porn websites like Pornhub, Xvideo, and others. And compared the image of the women in the porn videos with their actual Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and other social media platforms. So the idea was to create a database that if you like this porn star, this is her real life Facebook account, which is really insane. So you create this sort of database and then, of course, you can just imagine, forget the ethical concerns, the moral, like how terrible this idea is, but like just like how women are going to be discriminated, you know, sex workers are going to be outed,
murdered,
what? Of course. So somebody thought this was a really great way to, you know, use their amazing tech and innovation skills.
Let's switch gears a bit. I want to talk about some research that we're doing over at Policy as part of the feminist internet research on this very topic. So yes, I'm very biased and I have lots of opinions about this. And first, I want to take you through the feminist principles of the internet, which I think are a very interesting way in envisioning a new internet that works for women. So these are a series of statements and they offer a gender and sexual rights lens on critical internet-related rights. So currently, there are 17 principles total, and they're organized in 5 clusters, which are access, movements, economy, expression, and embodiment. And these are all available at feministinternet.org. And yeah, as I said, it's a great way to think about what is the kind of internet that we want and where are we right now? So our research was focused on what do things currently look like in the African context. So we did research that was mixed methods, so qualitative and quantitative, in 5 African countries to understand what are the lived experiences of women in these countries? How do they relate to technology? How do technology platforms relate to them? What are the legal environments that allow gender-based violence online to flourish or to be challenged? And of course, because the onus of protection oftentimes falls in the place of women, so we also wanted to know, like, what steps are women taking? Because yes, there are a lot of digital security programs trying to train women, but their outreach still remains limited. And in my opinion, I feel that this should be given to girls as early as primary school. So these are some of the things that we really wanted to look at. And to give you a bit of a teaser, we found that about 30% of women had experienced some form of online gender-based violence. And alarmingly, a lot of these women were not aware of any policies or laws that were in place to protect them. And in a few cases where they did know the law, they didn't feel like it would work for them. And we heard lots of harrowing stories of women who had faced different kinds of harassment and different lengths. Like for some women, the violence would resurface again and again because of this perpetuity of the internet. I want to read a quote from the research from one of our interviewees in Ethiopia. And it says, "From my stand, I would say Telegram is an unmanageable communication media. It is worrying and out of regulation. You can't do anything about it. We can say that the Facebook community standard is weak. It can't fit with the community that it has, but the good thing is that it has a regulatory system. Revenge porn on Facebook takes a few seconds until AI recognizes it. After that, it is immediately taken down. If your images are posted on Telegram, you can't do anything. They won't take it down as far as I know."
You know, that is really powerful and so relevant for where we are now, right? Like, so when women's videos and pictures are leaked, what standards are put in place? So if you look at Telegram, for instance, and Nima, you and I did try to actually, you know, go through Telegram and see how can we report the picture and everything else, but it was utterly impossible. So these, you know, these platforms are at the mercy of the admins, who in most cases would most likely be men, would not care about the content that's being shared. Well, and if you look at, if you compare it with Facebook, and I definitely agree with the interviewee here that Facebook has many, many, many problems, but at least there's some channel that that you might be able to get a response. So their content moderation seems to be, in, at least in this context, a bit more progressive than these other platforms. But I'm thinking, like, forget Telegram and Facebook. Look at all of the indigenous platforms that we have, like EthioTube. So that's very common in Ethiopia and many others. What's their content moderation policy? How do they take down content? I remember on EthioTube, there was a video that went a few years ago viral of a woman being abused and burnt with a lighter. And it was almost impossible to take it down. I don't think even that they took it down. So you can just imagine, you know, like Telegram and Facebook might be reachable, but all of these other small platforms that are up and coming, how will you be able to reach those ones? What is their policy? How do they put these measures of privacy and security within their designs? And in most cases, they don't.
Yeah, that's really disturbing. I think this also goes into this topic of organized trolling, which I actually think is pretty common in Kenya. I have here another quote from an interviewee that is based in Kenya, and she said, "Online threats are mainly organized trolling. I've received death threats. They come up with campaigns or a hashtag so they can rant at me all day. These insults are based on me as a woman, my anatomy, my family. They will use parts of the female body. The insults are so personal. There is a time I considered leaving Facebook and Twitter because the trolling became so bad. They use money and people to troll me online." And this is what we consistently see online, that if you are an activist, if you are a politician, a journalist, someone in media, you are, of course, a high target for these kinds of attacks. And this basically leads to the silencing of women and the exclusion of women from online places, because our research showed that many women, in response to online gender-based violence, about 20%, they leave these online platforms altogether. Yes, a lot of people block or delete or ignore, but we should consider how many people are just deleting their digital identities because of this violence. And on the other hand, how many women are not coming onto the internet because of fear of this violence? So our research only talked to women who have access to the internet. So we don't even know how many women do not access the internet because they're afraid of this toxic environment that they find.
Yeah, so it's, you know, the question is, the offline implication of this is insane. We've seen online violence, you know, targeting of women taking a shape in the offline world. So you were fired from your job. It has so many real life implications that this should definitely be a priority for a lot of platforms, for a lot of governments, you know, for the legislative process, for the judiciaries that we're engaging with. But we're not seeing this as an agenda for a lot of governments or even platforms. It's quite disappointing.
Yeah, I agree. And the other point that was brought out in the research was how there's very little representation from technology platforms in the African context. Mm. When, you know, I did rough calculations, Sub-Saharan Africa accounts for 15% of the world. It's over 1 billion people. And yet, can we count on our hands how many reps Twitter has on the African continent? You know, for example, as I said earlier, a lot of the burden of digital safety is on women, as always, right? Like, don't be raped rather than don't rape. And solutions focus oftentimes on women reporting the violence, documenting their experiences, and sometimes triaging them to emotional support. Or sometimes building an awareness campaign, like saying, oh, there is online gender-based violence. But what are the interventions out there to prevent the violence from happening at the same time? I feel like that I haven't really seen.
No, my answer to that is no. That doesn't exist. That's not there. And, you know, what's always really unfortunate when it comes to gender-based violence, whether online or offline, there's always an outrage. There's always a response when something happens to women. If you look at India, 2012, I think, when a woman was raped and killed, I'm not sure about the exact year, but that's when people were extremely outraged. If you look at Ethiopia, it's the same thing. No one wants to put the measures in. No one wants to preempt all of these things and mitigate for it. It's only when a woman dies, and an acceptable woman, right? Like somebody that the public can feel like that they're, you know, this woman deserved to live. Sorry that this podcast is very depressing. We did not mean for it to be this depressing, but go ahead, Nima. I don't know how to pick up the...
But it's important to talk about.
Good vibe.
Yeah. But going back to what you're saying, I think that there is a huge opportunity to tackle the issue. And not to be on the side of overregulation, but there is a need to strengthen online harassment laws. I don't think regulation is the solution for everything. But in terms of deterring perpetrators, I think that if there is a strong law enforcement, that things can be improved, but only if this law enforcement is from a gender-sensitive lens. So for example, if a woman reports to the police, can they provide technical assistance? Can they give a one-on-one digital security training? Can they offer counseling? Can they offer support? Can they offer legal help in getting justice? Only then do I think that it makes sense. And the other thing that we mentioned in a previous episode is that countries need to adopt these data protection and privacy laws. And it's not just adopting the law, but also hiring the commissions and the mechanisms to implement these laws. Because now it's been a year since the Data Protection Privacy Act was passed in Uganda, but we still don't have a data protection office that is responsible for implementing this law.
So the reality is, again, that, you know, when women go to report rape, they're not taken seriously. So the assumption that, you know, law enforcement agencies would be acceptable to the idea of prosecuting revenge porn and everything else and not blaming women. I'm like, you know, in the next 20 years, maybe on 2040, maybe, you know. But it's even this thing where it's just, I don't know. This is not working out.
A lot of the women said that when they did try to report, the police would ask, show us where they hurt you.
Oh, wow.
In the case of online violence. So, yeah, what do you even say to that? You just walk out of the police station?
That is so... And, you know, and I can imagine, like, show us where they hurt you, because it has to be physical.
And even if we did show you, what would happen? Nothing.
Yeah, basically. So we're all wasting our time.
Yeah. Well, the last point that I wanted to bring up was this need for feminist research. So our research was very much grounded in feminist principles, and we need methodologies that give voices to the perspective of women and marginalized groups who might not benefit from traditional research methodologies. We need to accept that women in the African context are knowledge experts in their own lives and in the future that they want. So enough of these helicoptering in, deciding what people want, and then giving them something they don't need. And we need to challenge the status quo where African women are just seen as this homogeneous group that don't have intersectional needs of, you know, gender, race, ethnicity, class, age, sexual orientation, disability. And how do all of these things impact how women access and interact in digital spaces? This is an exact example of Twitter having one representative for Africa, right? Africa is not a country.
Well, yeah, no, that is definitely true. And I think maybe to end this in a good note, there are many projects that are trying to empower women and how they share, for instance. So there's this really amazing project in Brazil that a friend of mine was involved in, and we'll make sure to put the link in the podcast description there. So they're trying to teach women how to send safe nudes. So the idea is like you have the power to share your own picture, your own body in many ways that you want, but here are the safest ways that you can do it. I think they even provide servers that would enable people to do that. So that really is, you know, flipping it and saying, okay, this is a problem that we're seeing. This is how you can be empowered to protect yourself and the people that you love. So, you know, we all just have to act in a manner that, you know, the patriarchy is never going to change. These platforms might not necessarily be fit for us. So we create our own space.
That's it for this episode. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the podcast, send us some love. You can find us at termsandconditions.africa or on Twitter at TC Africa Podcast. I'm at Nima Iyer on Twitter.
I'm at BTAYEG on Twitter.
All right, that's it. And take care, stay safe, stay indoors. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.